Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And this is definitely an author's corner segment as well. And to talk about this man and specifically how he's changed many different sports. He's a tremendous entrepreneur, amazing guy for sure. He is the senior vice president of the Orlando Magic. He's now a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, and he wrote a book that's very, very interesting. 21 Great Leaders, Learn Their Lessons, Improve Your Influence. Pat Williams. Pat, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Neil, I'm doing very well, and I appreciate the invitation. Look forward to our visit here.
Oh, absolutely, Pat. And thinking about why write this book, I mean, you're an author of like almost 70 books. What gave you the idea for this book?
I've always been fascinated with leadership, Neil, and I speak about it a great deal and have written about it many times. But the real issue here was to examine who we felt were the 21 most impactful leaders of history, you know, the last couple hundred years of history, and what can we learn from them? More importantly, what lessons can we pass on to our generation based on the leadership style or the leadership effort of these legends? So we did a chapter on each one of them, and then at the end of each chapter, we list three or four or five leadership points or lessons that you can take and apply in your world of leadership. So there are a few aspects to this book that I think are different and unusual. And above all, you get a look, a really deep look at the 21 leaders we feel, you know, are the most significant that have crossed our paths or have been out there or are still out there.
Definitely, Pat. And when I was looking at the list, they are from a variety of backgrounds and social aspects as leaders in different fields. So that's the interesting part of this. And I bet you they all have some similar qualities, don't they?
Yes, they do, Bill. And I'm convinced that, I'm convinced that there's seven qualities that it takes to be a great leader, seven ingredients that all great leaders have, whether currently or, from history: vision, communication, people skills, character, competence, boldness, and a serving heart. So that's what we believe really it takes to be a complete leader, and that's what the point really I think that we're trying to get across in this book and examine these different leaders based on their greatest strength as a leader.
Definitely the greatest strength as a leader, and I like the part you talk about a servant's heart, to basically go out there and know, even as you're leading millions of people possibly or as many people, you always have that idea that you're willing to serve and help. I mean, because you're not going to be inspired by a leader if they're not going out there and trying to do what you're doing or understanding what you're doing, right?
Neil, let's talk about that whole issue of a serving-hearted leader. The mindset of a serving-hearted leader is this: it's not about me, it's about you. It's not about building my resume, it's about building yours. It's not about advancing my career goals, but it's about advancing yours. It's not about my success, but it's the success of you and this organization that I'm leading. I really believe that's how a serving-hearted leader thinks. He or she is not there to dominate people, to intimidate them, to browbeat them, maneuver them, manipulate them. That's not the thinking, but it's always, you know, how can I best serve? And when a leader really grasps that concept, Neil, and puts it into practice, oh boy, that's when families change, and that's when organizations change for the better. That's when nations change. I just don't think we can put enough emphasis on the heart of service that great leaders possess.
I agree. Where did you think you learned this quality? what time period? Because think about the teams that you've been able to help grow to winners, and looking at specifically finding the right players and cogs in certain organizations you've been involved with, and all the way down to your days in baseball, and especially learning from great leaders. Where do you think you learned that quality? Because I think that I find that fascinating and interesting, because you look at two of the leaders, Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II, are on that list, and that could surprise people. For and I wanted to jump into that because that really interests me for sure.
Yeah, you know, they certainly would model a serving-hearted leadership. Probably it came to a head for me, Neil, in my 4 years as the general manager of the Phillies Farm Club in Spartanburg, South Carolina. One of the owners of our team was a man named R.E. Littlejohn, who was really in the oil transportation business, but loved baseball. But as I spent those 4 years with him, it was very obvious that this was a man with a serving-hearted mentality.
Yes.
People would come to visit with him, you know, pastors or businessmen or sports people or coaches, and, you know, just to sit at his feet and learn from him and study and, you know, and have him help them. I mean, he did this constantly, and I saw it and I watched it. And I noticed, I didn't have a word for it then, but that was a serving-hearted mentality as a leader. I saw it there for those 4 years I was with him. He didn't talk about it. He didn't have a name for it, but he was practicing serving-hearted leadership constantly. And as I look back now, I can see that it was modeled in front of me for those 4 years.
And you were willing to work hard and work hard for him. And I think that that's the key component. When you know that your leader is caring for everyone on the team, people are more willing to go the extra mile for you. They're more willing to do what it takes that's necessary. But when there's just fear, a lot of times fear leads to hesitancy and not, you know, stepping up the game for your team for sure.
Well phrased, Neil. Well phrased. You're not going to really do a good job if you're constantly intimidated or fearful of your owner or your boss. You know, that's not a pleasant feeling to run around with a knot in your stomach all the time. We've got a serving-hearted leader now in our owner, prime owner Rich DeVos. He is the co-founder of the Amway organization and models and practices serving-hearted leadership constantly, not just with his work with Amway, but we see it here with the basketball team. That is exactly how he goes about it. And when you have a serving-hearted leader, boy, you want to do the job for them. You work extra hard.
Yeah,
you really want to please that man or that woman simply because of their serving-hearted approach, and they just set a standard that makes you want to really, really produce results for them.
And that's fascinating. And then there's seven areas which you talked about in your listing. And I want to go into specifically one of those areas and what that leader brings to the table. Because, I mean, everything. I think one, if we go from serving, but ultimately you're not going to be successful in business if you don't have a vision. Visionaries are people who can come up with an idea that's different than anybody else's idea and have the right team in place to be successful. You need all those skills, you said, to be a great leader. And vision, you talked about vision. Well, the one person I bring up is Sam Walton and how much of a visionary he was. And I'm sure you mentioned that in the book for sure in the whole process of vision.
Sam Walton is a good leader to study, Neil. There's no question about it. Yeah, you know, he had a vision, you know, that little store of his up in Northwest Arkansas. And now the worldwide empire, did Sam see all that? Listen, he probably did. He had a big-time vision, and that's what great leaders have. He was able to communicate the vision. There's no question about it. And Mr. Sam had remarkable people skills. He was a man of character. You know, there were no character flaws in his makeup.
Right.
And then competent, yeah, very. He had competence and boldness. Listen, you're not going to build an empire like Walmart without a lot of bold decisions. And then the serving heart. I study Sam Walton. I think he really possessed that. He was a seven-sided leader, Neil. and worthy of studying.
Well, I saw a documentary on him and everything, and we hear certain things about Walmart, but ultimately what he tries to do is why it's a success. He looked at the customer. He looked at what's going to be best for the customer to make it easier so that people that are not making as much money can still afford and be able to have other money in their pocket, and plus provide the right place to grow in certain ways as a family and certain things. So it's really interesting to look at all these leaders. And always, here's the funny part, if we go through that list of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, that some of these leaders, Nelson Mandela, were not liked by everyone. So that I don't know where we put that situation. I think being bold, because if you're not bold and willing to continue to persevere through hard tasks and have this belief it's going to be successful, you're going to give up if you have naysayers, right?
Well, I think you've got to make tough decisions, and with that, you're going to have some disappointed people and people who are not going to like it. But at the end of the day, I think George W. hit it on the head years back in Washington when he said, "I'm the decider. I decide what's right." Well, that's what leaders have to do. If you don't have a decider there, someone who's willing to make bold decisions, you know, that organization is not going anywhere. And George W. took severe criticism, but he never backed down. And that's what we notice with great leaders, Neil. They make those tough calls, those tough decisions, and have learned to live with them. And they're not worried about their popularity. If that's what's driving you, popularity, I don't think you're going to be a very effective leader.
No. And I think that's the biggest problem, because you have to look what's best for your organization, for you and the public, and have success. Because at times, some people aren't going to like you. And that's just life. You can't please everyone. And then that goes back to another leader that you put out there, Mother Teresa. There were people that did not like her. You know, and she had to struggle many times to being persecuted and going through certain things just to continue for her vision that a lot of people around her, because I saw her biography as well. So there's certain people I really have a good understanding of, and that they looked at her like she was foolish. What are you thinking? You need to get out of the streets of Calcutta and go to a nice place and be safe. You're never going to get the money needed for your missions and all these different charitable things. And she had the faith in God that it would happen, and it did.
Yeah, that's well phrased, Neil. And you know, she was reporting to a party of one. She was there to serve the Lord. That was her calling, and she knew there would be critics and those who would demean what she was doing. But I don't think it really affected her. You know, she was there to do God's work on the earth, and that was her calling. And she set an example for all of us about serving others. I think you could read and study her life and come away much better for it. By the way, John Wooden, the great UCLA coach, had two life heroes, Abraham Lincoln and Mother Teresa.
Oh, wow.
The third one was Billy Graham, but those are the three people that Coach Wooden really respected and looked up to. And I visited his condo a number of times in Encino, California. You would walk in and there would be a display there at the entrance area of Lincoln and Mother Teresa, pictures and books and so forth. You know, those were two heroes of Coach Wooden.
Well, that's tremendous to talk about leaders and how we find and model people that if we want to be a successful leader, we got to study the greatest leaders and see what those qualities and characteristics are and try to form those characteristics and qualities. And you'd be surprised. Well, what are you looking at Mother Teresa for? She didn't make any money. Well, you got to look at what her mission and vision and where she was going in life. And then that helps in so many ways. What would you say who really out of this list of 21 you're inspired most by on a daily basis? Would you say some of these that you really emulated yourself throughout your growth as a leader?
Well, I'd certainly put Walt Disney on that list, Neil. I moved to Orlando 29 years ago to help start the Magic up as an expansion basketball team, but I also got Disney eyes, and I kept running into senior Disney executives who had worked with Walt Disney back in California, and so I would always pick their brain. And then I wrote a book called How to Be Like Walt, in which I interviewed or talked to just about everybody who knew Walt or had worked with him, and I was so fortunate to get to those people before most of them have passed away since. And so I learned a great deal about this remarkable man, this remarkable American hero, about his vision and how he communicated the vision, his people skills, a man of great character. He was certainly competent and bold. Oh, my goodness, Neil, he would make tough decisions constantly.
Oh, wow.
When his staff would disagree with him, but, you know, he, and when they did, he knew he was on the right track. So the bold decisions that Walt made are just staggering. And I think he had his heart was a heart of service. He wanted to entertain people. He wanted to provide fun for as many people as he could. And over the years, when you think about it, Walt Disney, to this day, has probably touched more people in the world than anybody that's come along in the last 100 years. And that will continue, I think, for probably as long as we have an Earth. You know, he is never going away. The impact of Walt Disney is just staggering. So I was fortunate moving to Orlando to really plow into his life, and it's made a big difference for me.
Well, it seems like a big difference. Everyone needs to check out Pat Williams' different information and see the amazing things that he's been able to accomplish in his career in sports, and how he was this innovative thinker, and looking at you in general, all the different characteristics that helped you become a great leader. Now, who do you hope reads this book? I know people that want to be leaders, any type of leadership position, teachers, anyone that has to lead others, definitely should read this book. But what group of audience are you targeting the most? Do you think entrepreneurs? Do you think CEOs? What is your thought in this process of learning about all these fantastic leaders and utilizing qualities?
Well, Neil, I'll tell you what, I think the book will benefit people from junior high up to senior citizens. You know, we wrote it in such a way that you know, anybody can grasp it. It's readable, you know, for anybody really, and anybody who has some leadership potential or wants to learn more about this important art, they're going to learn from 21 different leaders. And I think the key is at the end of each chapter, we list the leadership lessons you can learn from that particular leader. We list 4 or 5 after each chapter, so I think that's helpful. People can see that and say, okay, this is where I need to apply this to my life of leadership. So I think that's the best answer I can give to your question.
I agree with you as well. We all need to be leaders. We lead as a parent. We lead as a grandparent. We lead as someone involved in the church. Whatever our leadership is, whoever we're leading, because we all lead someone at one point in time. That learning these lessons and characteristics and building upon them will make you much more successful in life, not just in business or in your job, but also at home, family life, all these different areas, because a great family needs a great leader, right, Pat? That's for sure.
I think you nailed that one. Everybody listening to us here is in a leadership position, whether you're a father or a mother, a grandparent, whether you are involved in some part of your church or the PTA or youth sports in your community, everybody's a leader. And listen, if you do nothing but lead yourself, you're in the leadership business. So I think it's important to learn all you can about leadership, study great leaders, take what you can and apply them to your own life. I think all of those lessons are vital.
Absolutely. So where's the best place we can find information on you, Pat? Learn more about you. Purchase your book. Where's the best place? We can purchase the book on Amazon or any bookstore, but where else can we find info on you?
Yeah, I think that's the answer. Amazon's a great way to order books, and head to Barnes & Noble or Books A Million and get the book there, or barnesandnoble.com is an excellent way to do it. And people can always visit my website. It's patwilliams.com. And the Twitter page is Orlando Magic Pat.
Yeah.
And I'd be happy to hear from your listeners.
Yeah, I was checking it out and saw the tweet when you were on Fox and Friends and stuff like that. So you're definitely a mover and shaker still with the responsibility of the Orlando Magic. You keep busy for sure, Pat. Your days must be – that would be an interesting thing to see a leader's day, how a great leader is able to manage an entire day. I'm sure one of your 70 books you've written something about time management because I'm sure your day is very busy. So thanks for spending this time with me, and I learned a lot about who you are and especially about the book, and can't wait to read it. This is one book that I get thousands of books in the mail every year, and I have no time to read any of them. Well, this one I'm picking up and reading. So thanks again, Pat.
Hey, thanks, Neil.
All right, take care.
I'm delighted we could visit, and I appreciate this very much.
Well, best of luck to you. Take care now, okay? All right.
Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+. And this celebrity is a celebrity and celebrity chef in so many ways. It's so interesting, and I love his passion. I got to talk to him off air right before the interview, so I'm excited to welcome the program, Chef Jason Roberts, celebrity chef. And I tell you, you're on the Chew, and you're author books, you're helping children, you do so many different things. So, Chef Jason, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having us. Hi to all the listeners. I'm super excited to be here.
Whoa. Live audience, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell. And you're driving back to the hotel room because you're constantly in motion, Chef Jason, aren't you? You're always going places.
Yeah, it doesn't sort of really stop for me. I go from place to place to place. I think, you know, I learned to diversify out of hospitality maybe 12 years ago. And, you know, from books to touring and traveling and working with children and bike riding and tap dancing and everything that goes with it.
You seem
it's
like
been a crazy thing.
You seem like unlike any other chef I know. I mean, just the motivation, the excitement, the way you're going, and you promote healthiness, and that's so key. We're talking about so many cooking shows out there, and so many places are promoting fatty foods, and all it's leading to is a problem why our healthcare system is the way it is in the U.S. and all these different things, and so many people are obese because all we see are bad foods on TV. All we see is promoting high calorie food, and restaurants are full of it, aren't they?
Yeah. Look, Neil, someone said to me many years ago, don't trust the skinny chef. I mean, what do you mean? Don't trust me. I think it's it's an old adage that sort of rings true. Or does it really? I guess I'm the guy who wants to be a little bit more health conscious and teach people the benefits of eating well. And then when it comes to it costs this country billions each year in health issues, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, osteoporosis, all these things are on the rise, and they're all lifestyle related. So, you know, food, eating well, rest and relaxation, and when it comes to, you know, to weight management, it costs a lot of money to for people to try and pull this back into perspective.
That's a good point. If you want to pull through a fast food restaurant, you can get 3 burgers for $3, or you pay $6 for a grilled chicken sandwich, where you would least...
Well, exactly, and for those people who count calories, you know, you get a double cheeseburger and fries, it's 1,000 calories. You know, I've been fortunate to work with a weight management product called Body Key, probably for the last few years, and the whole idea is trying to reduce that calorie intake. But outside of that, it's teaching people to eat colors versus calories. You know, count the colors during the week that you've eaten. You know, as far as, you know, beets, tomatoes, and carrots, as your reds, your greens, and oranges, and things like that. Be more conscious of your food source. I like to tell people to eat the rainbow.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Eat the rainbow is a great thing, but it's so much work. I'm being honest, Chef Jason. It's so much work. Yep. My wife does a tremendous job of cooking a home-cooked meal every night, and I'm very blessed in that certain way. But if I'm trying to do this stuff, it's not happening. So there are a lot of working parents out there that are sitting there and saying, and that's a good point of the initiative, or even working people, that, you know, I don't have time for this, Chef Jason. I don't have time to go and prepare these things. Yeah.
Neil, I have to share this with you, my friend. You think about it. When you go to the doctor and they read your last rites, okay, you've got cancer, you've got heart disease, you've got diabetes, who do you blame for that? Who do you blame?
Blame myself, yeah.
Exactly. Ignorance isn't bliss. So you have to take control of this. And I totally get it. Single parent, 2 and 3 jobs, 2 and 3 kids, can go to a burger store and get a change from $5 up buying 4 burgers. I totally understand that. But you know what? You have to take life and food into account that you are responsible for your health. And if you don't do it now, you're only going to be spending the money further down the track for your medical bills. So it's not as hard as people make it out. They think, well, I can't. How do I eat healthy and make it more affordable? Well, it's totally doable. You find that you actually eat less when you cut out the sugars and all the overprocessed white flour, white sugars. I went gluten-free 3 years ago. Not only did I drop 15 pounds, I got my life back. I got my freedom back. And it wasn't just dropping the gluten. You know, and I'm not blaming gluten for the issue that I had with gluten. I'm blaming what we've done to gluten for the issue that I have. So it's totally toxic, as are a lot of the foods we eat. So start looking to your food sources, and where you can, when it comes to shopping, you can bring your food costs down by just buying smaller portions. We tend to waste 60% of all the fresh food that we buy anyway, because we throw it out. So learn how to cook.
And then that's the thing. Learn how to cook, which I can't do.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
You know, there's an old saying, and it rings true. You know what? Give a man a fish, leave for a day. Teach a man a fish, leave for a lifetime. There are too many cooks on television who are out there banging their own drum and, you know, believing the hype when they should be there teaching people how to cook. Who cares about, you know, for America's largest hamburger or America's largest? People care because they're watching it, but you know what? It's not helping anyone.
It's
time to put the foot down, Neil.
So let's talk about again your new cookbook, Good Food Fast. I like the word good food fast because we just don't have the time. How can we have good food fast, especially someone that's not versed in the kitchen? My wife would tell you that's just one thing I don't do. I clean. I do everything else. I cart the kids to school. I do all these different things, but when it comes to cooking, I'm out of the kitchen. Yep. Help me, please.
Yep. Okay. So good food fast. I like playing on that terminology, fast food. And we can see fast food as bad food. But I believe we can have good food fast. So it just comes down to preparation. And I tend to run my kitchen, I'm like I would a restaurant, and anyone could do it. You know, you don't turn up to a restaurant in the morning and thinking you're going to feed 300 people and have no preparation. But I can do the same thing at home for myself or, you know, my family, but by having a few things done in advance. So there are dishes that may take, you know, 2 to 3 hours to cook, but you're going to eat it. You're going to get 7 meals out of it. Or there are those dishes where I'm utilizing a mandolin and I'm doing a lot of raw foods as well. I'm teaching people within that book how to shop and be a little bit more resourceful. Here's the trick. If you take the word comfort out of your food and you're thinking health and nutrition, make your food functional, the food going into your system should be high-octane fuel to give you the energy that you need to get through a day. And then your world changes. Throughout this book, there are recipes for snacks, how to snack well. I think that's where we tend to fail. We don't prepare ourselves. We feel nice and thin and skinny in the morning. Think, oh, I'll make this last as long as I can. At 10 o'clock, you've left for work. You're cut short, and there's a vending machine with a chocolate bar, and you go, oh, I just need a quick burst of energy. And there's your 200 calories straight away where you could have actually prepared yourself a smoothie, an energy ball, grabbed a good bar or a snack bar or a wellness bar or something like that. And then you've got a little bit, you started metabolism, you've got your energy levels up, your concentration's good. And then you need the snacks throughout the day. So this snacking is what's important. So we think the big meals, they don't need to be as big as, you know, the American Texas burger style meal, but you need to constantly pick throughout the day. But good sources of fuel are important. So within this book, I've given so much information. I actually wrote with a woman, Stacey Colino, which helped me just from a nutritional standpoint of food, what you should be eating. To give you sustained energy throughout the day. It's actually changed my world. And the whole idea is that you just become conscious of eating.
So give me an example. You got to give me an example, all right? So when you talk about one example for snacking and one example for cooking and dinner. So if I said to my, okay, I'm going to get my kids a babysitter and I want to cook for my wife on Saturday, what would you say specifically I could do with no ability at all in the kitchen? You're talking to a teacher now, Jason, Chef Jason. So this is somebody, not talking to somebody that's some Joe Schmo. He can teach anything, but he can't teach. He's sure as heck. Let's see if he can be taught by you. Go ahead.
All right. So hold on. Where are you right now? Is it snowing?
What'd you say? Pardon?
Is it snowing where you are right now?
Oh, it's going to snow tonight. Yes.
Okay, so we need comfort. We need something sort of, you know, comfort food. So I'm thinking something from a four-quarter of maybe a lamb or a pig or a piece of beef. Do you need something that's preferably going to be a cheap cut of meat, that's going to be low and slow, something to stick in your crock pot? Let's just say we did beef shank. So let's get your crock pot on. You've got onions, carrots, celery. Put your beef shank in there. You could cover it with a bit of water, a little bit of stock, bay leaf, cinnamon stick. And then put that on to cook for maybe 3 or 4 hours. And if you've got enough shanks, there'll be enough for, you know, for a few people. Then you finish it off with some fresh tomatoes and fresh herbs. And then you could prepare some other vegetables with that. I mean, that's going to take a few hours, but it's, crock pot's one of the things you can walk away from. It'll turn itself off.
Crock pot's a great one. I wish my wife would use more of, because then she could put it on in the when she leaves and then not have to worry about it as much.
Those dishes like short ribs and shanks and you know, braised oyster blade and things like that are delicious. So if I'm thinking cool weather, I'm thinking something like that. Or, look, if you just want a quick meal that's going to happen relatively quickly, then something like a chicken breast split in half, a little bit of salt and pepper, browned on either side, and then just a quick raw salad of zucchini, mint, yellow hazelnut squash, salt and pepper, lemon juice. But then I'm thinking colors, so greens, yellows. Okay, you got your piece of chicken, so you got some protein. Not a huge portion. I'm thinking maybe about 5-6 ounces. And then outside that, you could do, you wouldn't do fresh tomatoes because it's not tomato season. Just whatever's local. Look to your supermarket, market what's in season. Maybe you'd be doing squash, like acorn squash, roasted acorn squash. But throughout my book, I've got heaps and heaps of recipes of side dishes and vegetable dishes to work from. As for a snack, popcorn, nuts, just packaged nuts. You know, I've got recipes for seasoned spiced nuts and caramelized nuts and popcorn and trail mixes with, you know, macadamia nuts and dark chocolate. Something's going to give you a bit of sustained energy. But smoothies, I love a smoothie. You know, one of those grab-and-go smoothies I can make. You know, I'll add maybe like a vanilla milk replacement shake. Protein powder. I will add like hemp seeds and chia seeds and goji berries and coconut water. It does get a little bit costly, but the thing is, I have got incredible energy after doing
this. Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's great ideas, and my wife cooks like that, so we'll give her. But I got to learn how to do that, especially with her working full time, and I'm the entrepreneur. I have the more luxury. Let me put that crock pot on after interviewing some superstar like yourself, and then I go ahead and I have it cooked, and then the wife comes home and says, "Wow, it's in the crock pot already. I've been able to take care of things." So definitely need to check out your book. One thing I love about one of the quotes that's in your bio, it's interesting. It says again that you talked about cooking together. A family that cooks together stays together. That's a great saying, and then we're going to get into your campaign. But tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, look, the reason I consider, cooking together, with your family is a good way to harvest and foster great relationships with your family. Your kids will put down the phone. But I think more importantly, to hand down traditional recipes and dishes from your grandparents. And I think it's something that's been lost. It's our chance to chat and talk. I love cooking with my son. You know, he cooks the lamb cutlets. He's only 10. He'll cook the lamb cutlets. And I'll cut up, we were just camping in Australia, so I was cutting up all the vegetables. He was doing the lamb cutlets. And it was something we passed cooking together. And I think it's important. I think the reason I got into cooking was because I wanted to be loved. And then when you cook with your family, you feel that love back. It's awesome. Super important.
No, definitely. I agree with you. And now your initiative is interesting as well. No Kid Hungry, that you're going to be kicking off in the U.S. and all these different places. Tell us the reason for that. And I think it's key because, again, look at childhood obesity. It's just, it's an epidemic for sure.
And look, and it goes beyond that. I guess childhood obesity could come down to poor sources of food to start with, on low, you know, low-income earners. But even though, you know, teaching people how to use food stamps, this is a big part of the initiative with No Kid Hungry and Food Matters. It's teaching people how to use food stamps and buying good sources of food as they're buying just bags and bags of bread and, you know, rice. Teach them how to use fruit and vegetables. So I've been part of No Kid Hungry for about 2 to 3 years now, and last year I rode from New York to D.C. With a group of chefs, we raised just under $25,000. This year we plan to raise a lot more with 25 of us riding two different routes. I'll ride both with another chef, who's a friend of mine, and we'll ride from New York to D.C. on one ride, and then the following weekend from San Diego to Santa Barbara, all the other way around. But all up about 600 miles over 6 days.
Amazing. And we talked about, and looking at that, it must make you really happy for kids to be, for parents to be educated to try to feed their kids the right foods. It must make you feel happy waking up every day.
You know, it does make me happy to do something like that. But you know what's ridiculous? There's 16 million children in this country actually turn up to school without breakfast or a packed lunch. It saddens me to the core. And, you know, Billy Shaw and Deb Shaw, you know, the co-founders of NoKidHungry.org, by the way, if you're interested in hearing more about them, are just great people. And they're supported by chefs, and chefs give up, you know, their time and their restaurants. And they've created this incredible platform for chefs to get behind and raise money. And so this bike ride is an opportunity for chefs to do a bike ride with me, and we'll raise some serious dollars. You know, I hope in my lifetime that I see that no child actually goes hungry, or no child has to choose between the quality or the quantity of their food.
That's so true. Again, we're talking to Chef Jason Roberts. And now let's go right to the interesting part of your experience on the Chew, because I'm sure people are interested in that, the popularity of the show. What did you think of being on that, for sure? Yeah.
It was cool. You know, it was a great show to be part of way back, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago when we shot the pilot. There was myself, Daphne Oz, and there were three others, Yvette Rios, Danny Boone, we were the original host. And what happened, though, is that, you know, ABC had just sort of canned two daytime shows, and they thought, well, you know, we need to invest in bigger names here. So they brought in Mario Batali and Carla Hall and Michael Simon, and then we were sort of put on hold for a moment, and then brought in maybe 6-7 months down the track as correspondents, which was sort of worked out really cool because I like being on the road. So I got to, you know, travel to LA, and I would, you know, I'd be out surfing and then coming into the Real Inn and cooking fish with the local, you know, store there, or I was up in up near Maine and was checking out, you know, America's largest pumpkin. It had its pros and cons. I felt like I was out there telling a story on how America has the biggest food around the country. But then, you know, in hindsight, I sort of didn't like promoting the fact that, you know, these foods were good for you and people were being happy, because I actually believe in health and nutrition, and people need to be made aware of the consequences of overindulging and not being conscious of their food source. So it had its pros and cons. I love working with Gordon Elliott, incredible executive producer. I love working with the ABC and certainly my friends and chefs who work on that show. But I'm looking to put myself in an area where I'm not burning a brand, and I need to teach people that, you know, just be conscious.
You have a great mission. Is there any other projects? Yeah, you are definitely on a mission, and I definitely think you're going to accomplish that mission, especially when you're seeing the healthcare push now and how we have to be more healthy and the initiative in the U.S. and, you know, calories on foods that people are seeing. It's just, you know, you see.
Yeah. I just said, look, I just turned 41, and I know how I feel about food and the way I see it, but what's interesting is I see a younger demographic of people with the same thoughts on food and super being really being conscious of living a holistic life and an optimal lifestyle when it really, really embraces health and nutrition and exercise. It's just a matter of pushing out that message and sharing it with people. And I found, you know, social media can be a necessary evil at times, because I find people, you know, who totally engage in weight management, they found that they've been able to keep themselves accountable by posting pictures of before and afters, and they have friends who follow them. They love to see the success and whatever. And they've been a big, you know, a big part of, you know, what I do. I'm currently in Hawaii with a corporate company called Amway, who I've been with for the last 10 years. And the social media aspect of this and working with Body Key and seeing people drop 50, 60, 100 pounds, has been an awesome adventure, and watching the success has been awesome. So I feel that, you know, social media will help people, I say, accountable to weight management. And it's definitely part of my my bigger plan is to help the kids, and through that, let's just see what happens. You know, bring down this deficit when it comes to the cost and the billions of dollars that are spent on in trying to keep this country healthy.
All right, Chef Jason, where's the best place we can find information on you, purchase your book, and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Okay, so if you go to my website, chefjasonroberts.com, you'll find my cookbook. You'll find a link to Twitter, Instagram, and lots of girly pictures of all my friends.
All right, because I heard you did post something to make me jealous, being in Pittsburgh in the cold weather, and you're in Hawaii. So I don't want to.
Yeah.
I wish I could be in Hawaii for sure. But it was great imagining that I'm interviewing you right next to you, but I'm not. But good talking.
I know.
You too, if you go,
and I know you're on Twitter right now, but, you know, I just posted your picture of me in the bamboo forest with the unicorn. You'll love it.
I wish I was there. But good talk, Youssef Jason. Best of luck with your initiatives and your book. And I'm going to make it an initiative to try to learn to cook for you, okay?
Good, man. Let's chat again soon. Take care. And anytime you need anything, hit me up.
I will. Okay, good talking to you. All right, take care.
Thanks, Neil. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Bye. You're listening to The Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to The Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And one of the biggest gripes I've always had is I'm getting all of these NFL players, but none from the Pittsburgh Steelers. I live in Pittsburgh. My flagship station's in Pittsburgh, and I'm constantly interviewing Ravens or Browns or Bengals or Patriots, and I'm like, why am I not getting Super Steelers? But luckily enough, the last couple weeks we have, so I'm excited to welcome the program, Pittsburgh Steeler, NFL star Ernie Mills. Ernie, thanks for calling, and man, I know that when you think about a team you played for, the Pittsburgh Steelers, in all your years, you think about the Steelers, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's where I got drafted from in 1991. In the third round, so naturally I got that great feeling for him, and I played 6 years there and in the Super Bowl for it. So that's where my heart goes immediately.
Do you think a lot of it does when we see about Pittsburgh Steelers and why they love the Steelers is because of the Rooney family? Do you think that's a big part of the tradition, that if you played for Pittsburgh, you truly feel you're a Pittsburgher in certain ways, in black and gold, even if you played for other teams?
Yes, because the Rooney family is definitely involved. You see them almost every day. And they're just, I think anybody that's ever played there, you know, they're just great, down-to-earth people. And that's not what everybody expects, having an owner of their team. So when you get there as a player, you can meet them and understand how they are. And it's just natural to feel great.
It's definitely, I think, the community aspect, the family aspect of the Rooneys, talking to so many people, and you felt at home there, didn't you? You felt at home with the fans and also the ownership, didn't you?
Yes, the ownership, everybody that you come across, and you know that they are Steelers, and you can see it. You see it in the eyes. You see it the way they light up when they meet you. It's just, Pittsburgh is a football town. And they love the Steelers, and that starts from the Rooneys to every fan that you come across.
I think there's only a few tradition teams like that where you see this is just that. This is the city, and this is the sport, and that's the Steelers, that's the Green Bay Packers, possibly the Dallas Cowboys. There are certain teams that you know that is their team. Forgetting the other teams, when it's time to talk football, they're going to talk Steelers. And I think that's such the great thing of traditions and stuff. Even though you hear about the Patriots and all these Super Bowls so far, you know the fact that when it's baseball season, they're thinking about the Red Sox. I still believe people will still have Steeler talk even when the Pirates are playing, even though they're starting to win. This is a Steeler town, and it'll always be a Steeler town. And that's what's so great about playing there, for sure. Now, Ernie, what was your greatest moment in 1995, your best year, the year that you went to the Super Bowl? What would you say is your greatest moment playing, like you can remember from that season?
Well, it's obviously the catch to in the AFC Championship game to help put us in the Super Bowl 30. So it's probably one of the biggest moments, and it was just an unbelievable feeling. I called the ball down to the one, and we went ahead for a go ahead touchdown. Van Moore scored, and everybody still remembers the Hail Mary that Jim Harbaugh threw. But the biggest moment for me was making the play to give us the lead to where they had to.
That made me nervous. I remember that one. I was in Arkansas at the time as a professional wrestler, and I was like, we're getting ready to say, okay, we got this one. And then I go walk into the living room, and I'm watching. I say, oh, no, here it comes. Because you remember the disappointment against San Diego the year before this stuff. You're like, oh, no. And I was happy that didn't happen. Oh, yeah. And when I think about
my biggest games was always in the playoffs. I mean, some of my biggest games was definitely in the playoffs, and I probably had more catches per game in the playoffs than I did over my whole career. So I love those games.
You knew when the big game was out, you were going out there and playing for sure. And looking at that team and looking at how high-powered an offense 95's team was going to the Super Bowl, you guys really were high-octane for sure. Kind of reminding you of what the Steelers are starting to become again for a lot of ways. You think of Neil O'Donnell and the ability that he had to, you know, make the big play and do the different things. That's what you were thinking about with that Steeler team. In 95.
Right. That's right. Neil had a great year that year. We started off the season 3-4. And starting off at 3-4, we were playing at 3-4 like we were already in the Super Bowl. And we got together and turned that season around, won 8 games in a row, and got ourselves into the playoff. And a lot of it was we pretty much score every time before halftime. And we developed our 2-minute offense, and then we just kept advancing it over the course of the season. So that opened us up a little bit. We opened the game up a little bit, threw the ball a little more, and became a little more open during that season.
Yeah, definitely. And it was a memorable year. Disappointing to lose to probably one of the best teams, the Cowboys. That year, that Cowboy team was unstoppable, and no one gave you a chance to even come close to winning that Super Bowl. And that was the hardest pill to swallow, because the year before, you never know what could have happened. But the AFCs were like the AFC wasn't going to beat the NFC in those years. Those teams were unbelievable, the NFC at that time in the 90s. Not like today, where you're seeing more of the parity. Now, Ernie, once you decided...
I felt like we were built to beat the NFC. I mean, we were built because our style of play was physical, and we ran the ball, and we were still able to throw the ball. So I felt like we were built to beat the NFC. So losing to San Diego, I felt like we would have played a much better game against San Francisco. And we actually felt like we would win the game against San Fran. You know, because we had practice against them, and we felt like we knew them pretty well.
Interesting.
And the same thing in 95, is aside for the first quarter, we pretty much dominated the game against the Cowboys. We felt like we could do that against, you know, NFC teams.
Exactly. So, Ernie, when you decided to hang it up, what were your thoughts and process where you were going to go next? Life after football. We talk about this all the time, and especially the younger athletes saying, you know what, they better start thinking about it. At one point, they're going to have to retire. And what are you going to do with most of your life? Because football is such a short time, short period professionally in life. So what did you decide to do? Right. Did you have an idea once you were retired?
No, I didn't have an idea. I had an idea, but I didn't want to go into it right away. I did a coaching internship right after I retired. But I don't think I was really prepared, and I really didn't want to be a coach. But I did like it. And so, and I think about a year later, I did take a year off because physically I was beat up.
So I took the year off, and I took the year off and started my own business. So I had a small business that I ran for about 3 years, and I did pretty decent with it. And but football was really calling me, and the coaching was calling me, and so I got into coaching, and I was coaching at the same time that I ran my business, mostly volunteering at high school and in a local college there in Charlotte. And so then I got into it full-time. I coached at Jacksonville University for 8 years, and I've been at Florida A&M University for the last 2 years. And so now I'm in between jobs right now. So, but coaching is what I've been doing here lately.
Interesting. So in a lot of ways, Ernie, you see that you went into life after football to be an entrepreneur, was a business owner, but just football was calling you. You wanted to continue to be a teacher and to teach people what you were successful in and help the younger athletes become better at what they do, and especially getting to the college level in so many ways. Do you think going back in your life before football, did anyone kind of help you in that process to understand about leadership and coaching and teaching when you were younger? That kind of goes back to once your career was over, how you wanted to do the same thing for others from experiences you had growing up?
Yes, I think it led all the way through. I played football in Little League, and it was great leadership with my Little League coaches. And on into high school, I felt like I had a great high school coach that is in the Florida Hall of Fame. So I had a great high school coach to follow and learn, and especially was taught a lot of discipline. And then once I got to college, I became a co-captain my senior year. You know, that just led to more leadership, and I just felt like I had those qualities, and it felt good to get back on the field. Felt good to teach the young men, and what I like about it is each young man is different, and just teaching them responsibility and discipline, and just watching them grow. And that's what makes it fun for me. That's what makes living being great to me, is watching young men grow, and especially the college level. They come to you as 18 years old. They think they know everything,
right.
And they get once they get to work, and they still really learn what it is to work hard. And I think that's the biggest thing that most young men, when they growing up, they don't realize how hard we work as professional football players. So I think that's the thing they got to. Most of them have to learn as they grow and come into the NFL.
Yeah, they have to learn and understand what it means to be, if you have the opportunity to play in the NFL, looking at the moniker student athlete and teaching them the importance mm-hmm. of getting an education, and telling them, Ernie,
right.
even through your experience of playing in the NFL, that life after football, you got to get yourself to understand life after, and understand specifically that even if you have the opportunity to play in the pros, that it's going to be short, and you have to have a backup plan, so you got to hit the books. So
right.
Do you...
Exactly. I got my degree before I made it to the NFL, and that's the only thing I felt like that I could control in my life. I couldn't really control how I was going to play. You're going against the best of the best. You really don't know. You don't know whether the coach is going to decide to play you or play someone else. You don't know, especially in the NFL, where the talent is so, everybody has similar talent. So I just felt like that I had to get my degree. I was going to get that. I control that by how much I study and how important I make it to me. So when I got to college, that was my number one goal. So I knew football wasn't going to last forever. And so, I heard someone say that it wasn't something to fall back on. It was my degree was something to step up on. So,
right, because there's another career after football.
Yes.
How many athletes, especially when you go to events and, you know, talk to young NFL athletes, you know, because I'm sure you go to football game, NFL games and stuff, and get to network with some of them and stuff, and to kind of give them that guidance to understand that, you know what, or mentor some of these young players, because they just don't understand at one point in time, even the kind of money they're making today, you don't, once you get on on the new field of life, the game of life, how are you going to handle it? Do you give any of the players advice or try to stay in touch with some of them that are especially on, let's say, the Steelers or different things to kind of give them, or even in Florida, to give them some advice and mentorship at times, for sure, with you seeing me? Yeah,
it's been mostly the ones that I've been involved with. I've been able to talk to them, and I've just recently got to where I've been to a few Steelers games in with years before I could get back to them or get up there, because I've always been coaching. So recently I've been able to get to some of the games, and when I meet them, we talk about those things. I'll tell you what, it's a refreshing to look at a lot of the guys. I know when you get some of the guys that come on the media, that's in the media, that may have a negative light on the league and themselves and their family. But if you look at the majority of the league, you got a lot of great men in the NFL that's playing in the NFL right now. And I think, you know, once you go and look at each team, and I look at the Steelers, there's a lot of great men on the Steelers team right now. And it's good to see. It's rewarding to see. I felt like it was the same way when I played. You know, you have a few, your rotten apples that people try to focus on the most. But the majority of the NFL has always been a lot of good men.
Yeah, and I agree too. I think that the NFL gets a bad rap with a couple bad apples, as any kind of profession does. From teaching to doctors, you run into the wrong person or hear in the news, then you think all of them are the same, and it's not the case at all. Very humble. I think the NFL does the greatest job in the community out of any professional sport, in my opinion. They're the most available to talk, either as current athletes or ones that have retired, because they truly see that this is a platform to help others in so many ways. Now, so you were saying, Ernie, basically you were with Florida A&M. Now you're in between not coaching. Do you have aspirations to get back coaching again?
Yes, I'm currently looking. I recently had knee surgery to try to help me stand up on that sideline a little bit. So I've been trying to get healthy the last couple of months from the last last 10 to 12 years of standing on that sideline. And so I'm feeling a lot better now after surgery. I've gotten off the crutches. So I'm just looking around now and I'm trying to get to the right spot and to be able to help some young men. Either way I'm going to be, if I'm in coaching or not, I'm going to be helping someone out. So that's just that's what's in me. And right now I'm in Tallahassee, but I'm probably going to move a little closer to my hometown and then over Florida and be able to help those young men out as well.
Now, are you doing anything else currently? Right now, you're between coaching. Are there any projects you're doing or charity work you're doing currently, Ernie? Because I know you were doing some stuff working with being involved with the Steelers and events and making it back to Pittsburgh during the season. But is there anything going on that you're promoting right now, Ernie?
Not currently. Over the Christmas holidays, I did some things for the kids and. And toys and that type of thing, especially for single mothers. So I did a little bit of that to help that. I don't have my own foundation, but I just did a little volunteer work in that aspect. So I always try to stay busy and I help, and I always do charity things with some of the other players that they have going on. I get involved with that as well.
All right. Well, cool, Ernie. Best of luck in everything. I mean, I remember that season in 95. I remember the years that you played for the Steelers. And even though they never won the Super Bowl, because it was my age and the excitement of seeing the Steelers after being born, seeing the Steelers win four Super Bowls and then having those down years, the 90s were a fun time, and they were a fun time to see Pittsburgh sports back, especially when you're a teenager and you're cheering and you're excited about seeing all the sports and winning, and seeing the Steelers tradition come back was awesome. And I think it really led to the 2000s in so many ways. Is there a place we can find more information on you, Ernie, and learn more about you? Where can we go? Do you have a website or face or anything that you some people can contact you?
You can always contact me on my Facebook page. It's Ernie Mills, So you can definitely contact me on the Facebook page. And it's two of us, so it's me and my father, but I'm probably the one with the most friends. So you can always contact me on there. And I have a Twitter page, but I don't. It's Ernie Mills 89. I'm rarely on that, but of course, you can contact me on there. I enjoy playing for the Phillies. I had a great time. That was the greatest experience for me.